What's up, Devil Bingus?
Devil Dingus, how's it going?
Yes! Dude, it's going great. Let's get down to the important stuff, eh?
Yeah, let's get into it.
That's my friend Devin Udall. He was the kind of college student who was barefoot in the library, just cuz. And maybe that makes it not surprising that he's also the person who taught me everything I know about whitewater kayaking. I'm calling him because Devin's family has lived in the Southwest for 7 generations. And for more than one reason, they're deeply intertwined with the recent history of the Colorado River.
You know, of all the family lore, the most harrowing and infamous piece that I was aware of as a kid was that John D. Lee committed mass murder, basically.
Do you remember finding out about that?
Yeah, I think my earliest memory of that is my brother did a school project, and it was like the assignment was like, tell the class a story about your family heritage. And everyone had these sweet stories about their grandmas. And then my brother gets up and he's like, the Mountain Meadows Massacre.
You see, Devin is one of many descendants of a Mormon pioneer named John D. Lee and Lee's 19 wives. And his brother's presentation that he referenced was on the Mountain Meadows Massacre, which occurred on September 11th, 1857. On that day, Devin's great-great-great-grandfather, John D. Lee, led a militia of Mormon settlers to attack a wagon train from Arkansas. The militia massacred 120 people, a crime that would be known as the largest act of domestic terrorism prior to the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing.
It was a serious enough event that at one point, my grandpa organized like a reconciliation of sorts between the descendants of John D. Lee and the descendants of the victims of the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Because I think, you know, there were surviving children. So the descendancy from John D. Lee and the memory of that definitely lives on.
Following the attack, John D. Lee went into hiding by the Colorado River at a place that is now called Bee's Ferry.
It's a place where the river canyon kind of flattens out. And back in the day, it was like the only place like upstream of the Grand Canyon that you could get across the river and access the inner canyon from either side. And so I think that John D. Lee had a ferry there and he ferried people across the river. I think that's what he did while he was in hiding.
And so, as it turns out, Lee's Ferry was a great place to hide from mass murder, like one of the best places you could choose at the time. There was really nothing near it. Navajo Bridge wouldn't be built until 1929, and so Lee's Ferry was one of few places to cross the river. It was the lone break in the canyon walls for 200 miles in either direction. It's there that Glen Canyon fades into the ground and the marbled walls of Grand Canyon begin. My name is Evelyn Baher Murphy, and you're listening to Lifeblood, a podcast about Glen Canyon, Lake Powell, and the future of the Colorado River. Lee's Ferry is not just the space between Glen Canyon and Grand Canyon, and its relevance goes far beyond Devin's great-great-great-grandpappy. Lee's Ferry is the dividing line between the upper basin and the lower basin of the Colorado River. And to be clear, like most borders, this line is arbitrary. The day I was there, we were rigging our boats for a 21-day trip down the river. I went for a short paddle upstream towards Glen Canyon, and I probably crossed the dividing line. But I didn't notice, and for that matter, the canyon walls do not know that they are in the upper or lower basin, and the water notices no difference either. The division at Lee's Ferry, though, is important to the Colorado River Compact, an agreement that has largely determined how and when Colorado River water moves downstream. So the compact was signed in 1922 by the seven basin states. It quantified the amount of water in the Colorado River, and today it serves as the foundation of what we call the Law of the River, which essentially includes the compact and 50-some-odd agreements, court cases, and treaties that have followed it. Colorado River history buff and executive director of Glen Canyon Institute, Eric Balkin, walked me through the creation of the compact.
A core component of the compact in 1922 is that we split the basin into two pieces, right? When the states were trying to negotiate this compact, they couldn't come to an agreement, which resonates today, right? The states could not agree who gets how much water.
So to simplify their disagreement, the seven states split the river into the upper and lower basin. The upper basin would include Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico. And the lower basin would be California, Nevada, and Arizona. Each basin would then decide amongst themselves how they would share their half of the river. And the river in this context includes the main stem and all of its tributaries. So for the upper basin, use of rivers in the Rockies like Telluride, San Miguel, and of large tributaries like the San Juan and Green all count. And then all of that water kind of funnels into the main stem, into the Colorado River, and then down to the lower basin. Colby Pellegrino is the Deputy General Manager of Resources for the Southern Nevada Water Authority.
The Colorado River in the upper basin is a bunch of fingers. And so it's kind of like they're the lungs and we're the esophagus. You know, everything is coming through a single line to the lower basin.
To make sure that the upper basin didn't take too much water from their downstream neighbors, the seven states added a clause. Here's Eric Balkin again.
Another key component of the Colorado River Compact and the Law of the River is a clause that is mostly referred to as the delivery obligation. The upper basin has to deliver or must not cause the river flows to be less than 75 million acre feet over a 10-year period.
This means that the upper basin, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, and Utah, is required to deliver roughly 7.5 million acre feet of water every year past Lee's Ferry to the lower basin states. But what the hell is an acre foot of water? What's about 270,000 gallons? Or in layman's terms, it's like a football field covered in water 1 foot deep. So the upper basin has to pass 7.5 million wet football fields downstream every year. And the thing is, the upper basin has to be careful not to take more than their fair share. Because if they do, their rights to the water could be curtailed. And so I asked Nick Halberg at the Utah River Council what curtailment may look like.
If, for whatever reason, the upper basin doesn't deliver 75 million acre feet of water to the lower basin every 10 years, then we have to cut water use in the upper basin to make up for those missed deliveries. And the way that water use gets shared among the upper basin states, the way those cuts get shared, is by curtailment, which basically means if you're overusing, you cut a huge amount of your water to make up for the delivery. So if we go over allocation, we're subject to just really, you know, mandatory, potentially aggressive water cuts.
So what could go wrong? This all seems dandy, right? 7.5 million acre feet for the upper basin, 7.5 million for the lower. Nobody goes over their allocation and everybody's happy. But unfortunately, the seven basin states made three huge errors in their accounting. Accounting error number one was that the math they did to make up this number of 7.5 million acre feet was bad. It was bad math. Cynthian Eberle, the Southwest Communication Director of American Rivers, filled me in on this miscalculation.
In order to get that number, they used a very wet 10-year hydrologic cycle in the 19-teens. So if you look at the hydrologic record of the river, the 19-teens were one of the wettest periods of recorded history. And so they actually based this compact on a much larger volume of water that they assumed would be there year after year after year.
So in reality, instead of being a 16 million acre foot river, the Colorado River flows more around 15, 14, or 13 million acre feet. And with climate change impacting hydrology in the basin, it's really more like a 10 or 11 million acre foot river. So that's a difference of, at a maximum, you know, 6 million acre feet. So the estimations, and thus the delivery obligation, We're way off. And this just highlights a major flaw in our system of Western water rights. We treat water as a static resource. Flow estimations and static delivery requirements do not reflect the changing, living, breathing nature of a river system. Western water rights are built to fail. And then to add pressure to this overallocated system, the basin's population has ballooned since the signing of the compact.
When the original Colorado River Compact was signed, there was only about 500,000 people who lived in the Colorado River Basin. And they assumed that the basin would never have more than four times the amount of people in it than it did in 1922. So they assumed the basin would never be more populated than 2 million people. Well, today there's more than 40 million people in the basin. There's a $1.4 trillion economy that depends on the Colorado River. And you have billions of dollars of agriculture, you have billions of dollars of associated economic impacts from the river, and you need to supply water to 40 million people, not just 2 million.
A huge amount of people rely on this resource in the management systems we've put in place to organize how and when water flows. And that brings us to accounting error number two. The original compact forgot or just failed to allocate water to Mexico. They basically did all this math just pretending they could drain the river dry and not let it cross the border. Santiago Guerra is a borderland scholar and professor at Colorado College.
In 1910 to 1920, there's a lot of concern around the Mexican Revolution. We see the first foreign incursion into the U.S. in the 20th century when Pancho Villa attacks the U.S. at Columbus, New Mexico. And so there are rising concerns and in many ways animosity towards not just Mexico, but the Mexican descent populations of the Southwest. So it kind of makes sense that there is this sort of disregard for Mexico in that 1922 compact that later has to be revisited.
In 1929, 7 years after the compact was signed, the U.S. began repatriating people of Mexican descent back to Mexico. The U.S. government thought this would help white Americans have more economic opportunities during the Great Depression. And so, from 1929 to 1939, the government repatriated 1.5 million Mexicans, over half of whom were U.S. citizens. The U.S. was saying a big F you to all of those people and to Mexico as a country. While all this was going on, though, the U.S. wanted to smooth things over with their neighbor. They were like, okay, we don't want Mexicans in our country, but we also want to, you know, have a good geopolitical and economic relationship. So in 1933, they initiate a new policy.
The U.S. starts what it terms the good neighbor policy to have better relations between the U.S. and Mexico and the U.S. and the rest of Latin America. Now that comes in really sort of clutch when we enter the Second World War in the early 1940s and we see a labor shortage in the U.S. as a result of all of our servicemen fighting in the war effort.
So what we see then by the 1940s is that via the Bracero program, the U.S. federal government is all of a sudden now they're encouraging immigration of Mexican laborers to the U.S. This was hugely crucial to the U.S. wartime effort. And this was a massive switch up, you know, because not 5 years prior, the U.S. government, you know, they were repatriating all these people. They were kicking them out of the country. And what we see in 1944 is that the U.S. signs a treaty with Mexico that gave them 1.4 million acre feet of the Colorado River every year. And the thing about this treaty is it didn't like change the calculations they did in the compact. It just gave out more water rights. So it did not solve the issues of overallocation. It just ensured that Mexico had a right to the river too. And that's great. But at the same time, there was another group that still hadn't gotten their fair share. More on that after the break.
Hi, this is Seba River Outfitting from Flagstaff, Arizona. We're a full-service outfitter for non-commercial Grand Canyon river trips. From equipment and food to transportation and logistics, we take care of all the details so you can focus on the river. We're proud to support Evelyn's podcast on water issues in the Southwest, and we're honored to outfit many of the science missions in Grand Canyon. Planning your own trip? Visit sabeadventures.com to get started.
This episode of Lifeblood is brought to you by Firefly Kitchens. Flowing through 7 states and nourishing millions along the way, the Colorado River is a reminder of how powerful and essential the right kind of flow can be. At Firefly Kitchens, they believe your body deserves that same kind of vitality. That's why they handcraft wild fermented foods, krauts, kimchis, and tonics, alive with probiotics to keep your gut, immune system, and energy in balance. Each jar is made with care, flavor, and a whole lot of life. Because when your gut's thriving, everything else flows better too. You can explore their full lineup and order online at fireflykitchens.com. Firefly Kitchens, keep the good things flowing. This episode is also brought to you by Colorado River and Trail Expeditions. Looking to float down the Colorado River? Well, lucky for you, you can raft the Grand Canyon, Cataract Canyon, and more with Colorado River and Trail Expeditions. For over 50 years, Crate has been crafting world-class whitewater rafting trips through the West's most stunning landscapes. With Crate, you can raft through the heart of the Grand Canyon, hike to hidden waterfalls, and camp under the stars, all with expert guides who handle the details, so you can focus on making memories. Book your 2026 expedition now at crateinc.com. That's CRATEINC.com. Now, back to the show. That brings us to accounting error number 3. The 30 federally recognized tribes in the Colorado River Basin were also completely excluded from negotiations.
Colorado River Compact, it was 1922, and Native Americans were not made citizens of the United States without first having to legally disaffiliate themselves from their tribes until 1924.
Whoa.
Yeah. This is actually the century of Native enfranchisement, of their ability to be federal citizens. So it's pretty recent. So thinking about tribal issues was not anything on the radar of any of the folks negotiating the Colorado River Compact, except actually for Herbert Hoover, the federal commissioner to the negotiations. And sort of late in the day, Hoover was like, oh yeah, there's this other thing. Like that winter's thing happened a little bit ago and we might need to figure that out. And states basically were like, yeah, no, that's a federal problem. That's you.
That's tribal water lawyer Jay Weiner. And that winter's thing he's talking about was a 1908 court case that occurred 14 years before the compact was signed. It established what is known as winter's rights, and that case was actually initiated by the Fort Belknap tribe in north central Montana. In the late 1800s, settlers upstream of the reservation started farming with water from the Milk River. And the tribe was like,
well, hey, no, if you're taking that water, it's not coming to us. We can't use it for our irrigation project. And the upstream farmers basically said, well, you know, tough, you're not using yours, and we've started using ours.
And this sort of disagreement eventually made its way to the U.S. Supreme Court. So the court heard this case, and they said,
even though the treaty between the United States and the Fort Belknap tribes that created the reservation didn't say anything about water, the Supreme Court said, look, we're going to presume that the United States was operating in good faith. There is no reasonable construction of this treaty that if this is going to be a homeland for tribal people and somewhere where they're going to have to live and farm and grow and raise their members up, like that's got to bring water with it in some fashion. That's what Winter said. And so because the reservation predated the settlers beginning to develop, the court said that no, they've got to let enough water flow down to satisfy the tribe's uses.
So remember prior appropriation, the system of water law used in the West that says first in time, first in right? Well, the Winters decision basically affirmed that Native people and their tribal treaties are first in time, and thus necessarily predate settler water use in the West. This is hugely significant because it means that tribes have the most senior rights to water. And unlike other water rights, these rights are held in perpetuity. In states like Utah, there's a use it or lose it mentality. If I don't use my water right for 7 years, it's gone. But tribal water rights don't ever disappear. This is important because while the compact ignored tribes and allocated all of the water to the 7 states, the writers of the compact actually left in a provision that acknowledged the Winters decision.
Article 7 of the Colorado River Compact of 1922 basically just says, tribes have rights. It's a federal problem. We're not dealing with that here, but nothing that we're doing here impairs those rights. And so that last part about nothing in the compact impairing tribal rights kicked the can down the road to another day.
Some of that can being kicked down the road was to a court case in 1963 called Arizona v. California. This case established that California had senior water rights to Arizona's rights. But that aside, this court case gave five main stem tribes their water rights. So this was a huge deal. It was the first time tribes were getting water and that being kind of set in stone, written in paper. Then in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, we enter what experts call the settlement era. At this time, tribes would reach settlements with the federal government, often quantifying a smaller portion of their rights in exchange for federally funded infrastructure, which would actually bring that water to the reservations. But today, eight of those settlements are still pending, and some tribes still have not had their water rights adjudicated or quantified at all, meaning that the choice to ignore tribal water rights in 1922 is still being sorted out today, over 100 years later. So essentially, the Colorado River Compact took the river and first cut the pie in half at Lee's Ferry, half for the upper basin, half for the lower basin. But the compact has this imaginary view of the river. The pie does not necessarily have all the ingredients to be whole. So really, on an average, you know, normal year, there's only 75% of the pie. The river only satisfies 75% of the allocation that's been given out. But our laws are set up to include the imaginary extra amount of water that never even existed. And then you add Mexico and say, hey, there's enough pie for you, even though we never had enough pie. And the imaginary pie has just gotten larger. But the real one, it stayed the same. And so then now you have tribes and we say, there's enough pie for you too. And they actually get their pie, so it's kind of true. But there's not more to go around, just less for everyone else. That is overallocation. That is accounting failures. That is development based on imaginary water versus actualities. But the rules are the rules. And per the compact, the Upper Basin has to deliver 75 million wet football fields past Lee's Ferry every 10 years. To make this manageable and to essentially hoard as much water as possible, the Upper Basin needed a way to store excess water. And so enter the Colorado River Storage Act of 1956, basically legislation that approved a bunch of dams in the Upper Basin to hold all that water. And it also gave rise, or kind of gave a voice, to a small hiking club out of San Francisco who did their darndest to stop those dams from being built. But more on that next time. For a photo of my friend Devin Udall at Lee's Ferry, the place where his great-great-great-grandfather hid from mass murder, check out the show notes. If you want to read a book about the fictional future of the Colorado River, a book that I so badly want to read, so many people have talked to me about it, then check out this recommendation from Jay Weiner and St. John Eberle.
If you like, and I mean, I like speculative fiction, The Water Knife is a good look at, you know, sort of one version of a dystopian future if we are not able to figure out how to get ourselves a sustainable basin.
Paolo Bacigalupi paints a picture of a futuristic, not so far in the distant future, fight between Phoenix and Las Vegas. And it's not an unheard of idea that fights like that could actually happen.
Episode 2 of Lifeblood was produced and directed by me, Evelyn Baher Murphy, and made possible by support from the Hulbert Center for Southwest Studies, the Colorado College Journalism Institute, the Utah Rivers Council, Colorado River and Trail Expeditions, Firefly Kitchens, and Outdoor Odysseys Sea Kayaking. Music in this episode is by Abel Nelson, Sabrina Smith, and Elliot O'Brien. Special thanks to Devin Udall for teaching me to kayak and for sharing about his storied family.